Hi, I'm Todd Nathanson.
And I'm Lena Morgan.
And welcome to the next episode of Song vs. Song.
That's terrible. Ready to make an entrance, so back on up.
Yes, this week we are doing Dr. Dre and Snoop Doggy Dogg's Nothing But a G Thing versus Coolio's Gangsta's Paradise. And as a special guest, we have the most gangsta person I know, one Andrew Underberger of Billboard Magazine. Welcome to the show yet again.
Oh, thank you. What a lead in and well earned, I'd like to think. I appreciate you letting me come on just by virtue of my saying that I have strong opinions about this matter. You don't even know what the strong opinions are yet, although you might be able to guess.
I did not know, and I could not possibly imagine what those strong opinions are, except both of these songs are great.
Sure.
I feel very strongly that Nothing But a G Thing is a great song, and also that Gangsta's Paradise is a great song.
That is a strong opinion.
I can't wait to get into this. Do you want to just dive right in? Do you want to start with what we each prefer?
Yeah, okay. One, two, three, and to the four. To the foe. Go ahead, Lena. What would you say?
One of these songs is, to me, the birthplace of the popularity of gangster rap. And the other one is a song for a bad movie.
Oh, wow.
Understand, like, rest in power, Coolio. I'm not trying to come after this man. I have never thought much of Gangsta's Paradise.
I still don't think
much about that song. Whereas The Chronic is the greatest breakup album of all time.
Dr. Dre's blood on the tracks there.
Listen, I've never seen somebody break up with anybody the way Dre broke up with Eazy-E. That really is something else. And it's just one of the greatest songs truly one of my favorite songs of the decade, maybe my favorite rap song of the decade. Not the first one I heard off of that record, but I don't know. I have really strongly positive feelings about that song.
What was the first song you heard off that album?
It was Dre Day.
Oh.
I heard Dre Day first. Don't ask me how that happened, but I think it's because there was a popularity of the music video because it was so goofy. People like music videos, or they did at the time, where there's like a lot of story weaving in and out, and like the whole thing is just clowning on Eazy the whole time.
But by the way, real quick, I have to mention this because I only found this out like a week or two ago. Do you know who plays the fake Jerry Heller in that video?
Wait, who is it?
It's Steve Berman, like from all those later Eminem skits on Interscope
Records. What, really?
Isn't that incredible? I had no idea. Obviously, he wasn't Steve Berman yet, but like, I don't know why they thought like we need to get this like low level exec at Interscope to play this incredibly humiliating part. But God bless Steve Berman.
I did not. Outstanding.
I was not 100% sure that Steve Berman was even a real guy.
He's real. He's definitely
the
real.
More you know.
I thought he might be like Ken Kniff or something, like just part of the
Ken Kniff's
universe.
Also real too. Also an exec at Interscope at the time. Probably not. I don't know.
Okay.
All right. So that's my straight out the gate strong opinion. Underberger.
I'll start by saying that I do. Well, first off, these are like two of the probably the 10 rap songs that I know the best, just by virtue of, you know, when I first started listening to music in the mid 90s, and probably, you know, I can rap along to both of them pretty much the entire way through. I won't do that here.
Yeah, same.
And I do love Gangsta's Paradise a lot more than Lena, apparently. And it wasn't an opinion I always had. You know, growing up, it was kind of like it was just sort of in the background, like the Atlanta Olympics or something, where it's just like, I don't necessarily have to have an opinion on this thing that's just always there. But it really is kind of a great song, and like has a resonance that to a bunch of his lyrics that I didn't appreciate at the time. And I was lucky to get to edit something written by my favorite writer, Brad Shoup, who did a story on Gangsta's Paradise for us after Coolio died, and kind of pointed out a lot of the really interesting things in the lyrics and sort of the story behind it that I'd never really given proper credit. And we'll probably talk about more of that later. But just to say that I do think of that song as an achievement on some level, and it kind of holds a place in 90s rap and pop culture that no other song does. All that said, putting this song up against Nothing But a G Thing is a little like comparing Smells Like Teen Spirit to like Lightning Crashes, maybe, or Bush's Glycerine. Like it's funny, like growing up, like you realize that the canon that you have in your head is not the same as the canon that everyone else has in theirs. And that canon is always shifting for newer listeners and even for people who have just been around long enough. To me, this is unquestionably the most important and also the best rap song of the 90s. And it's the one that I grew up thinking like, okay, this will always be seen as the most important and best rap song of the 90s. It was always like number one on like when MTV would do its like top 50 jams of all time countdown. It was always number one. When they would do its top 500 videos countdown, it was the top rated rap video. And I just sort of assumed that would always be the case. I do think it's kind of become disrespected in recent years, in part by its creators. And that's largely due to its absence on streaming for a lot of that period. Because like with Death Row, The Chronic was kind of always weaving in and out of availability on Spotify and Apple Music.
Yeah, Snoop turned it into an NFT, I think.
Yeah.
For a little brief period.
And thanks to Snoop for giving it back to the real world. I appreciate that. but in the interim, it has sort of allowed 2001 and the singles from that album to kind of eclipse The Chronic and its singles in terms of Dre's like sort of preeminent work or whatever. And it did sell better, I think, in real time too. That's partly due to the sort of time and place. But to me, like The Chronic is always going to be his definitive album. This is always going to be his definitive song. This is one of the most important songs of any genre released in my lifetime, and also one of my favorite. Like it's just a perfect song. And like the Super Bowl that it didn't even get played at the Super Bowl, and partly that maybe that's
I remember you being pretty angry about that.
I lost my mind about that. Like, again, so that to me is like Springsteen not playing Born to Run or something. Like, it's like, yeah, you have other songs, but you also have this song, which is one of the greatest songs of all time, and everybody loves it. Why would you not play it? And I remember having a lot of conversations with like coworkers and other like bigger rap fans than me, even, who were like, okay, so? Like, they didn't see it as this gigantic snub that defied explanation and physics. I still do. It's a 10 out of 10 song. It's unimpeachable, both quality and significance. Like and Gangsta's Paradise, a very good song, just can't compare. And I did make like a short list. I mean, I might be getting too ahead of myself here. I did make a short list of like the ways in which Nothing But a G Thing like is the greatest of all time, and like very specific ways. Maybe we can come back to that later. I don't know, or maybe you just don't want me to read it at all. But like there's like a number of different things that it does that I think it is the best at of any rap song in history.
You know, it's a funny thing. I remember like asking people on Twitter once. So I was like, disregarding Smells Like Teen Spirit, what is the song of the 90s? Not even the best, but like the song. And I got a bunch of different answers, and I was like, why is no one saying Nothing But a G Thing? In fact, 30 years later, I would say, what is the best song and not include Teen Spirit? Like not exclude it. It's like, even its legacy may have surpassed Teen Spirit by this point. I am kind of shocked that I was shocked that they didn't play it at the Super Bowl. And it really does feel like its legacy has degraded, whereas Gangsta's Paradise has started high and kept going higher. Like, does that feel like what's happening to you? Because like Gangsta's Paradise feels much more present.
Yeah, this is something that you and I have talked about a lot too, in that like Gangsta's Paradise is the benefitor, I don't know what that word is, of basically not having much competition within Coolio's back catalog. And I don't even think that's right or fair, because he did have other hits at the time that were legitimately very big and very good. But history kind of winnows some artist catalog to one song, and that's definitely what happened with Coolio. Like, you look at the Spotify streams or any other like YouTube metrics, and it's like Gangsta's Paradise had over a billion and next highest at like 15 million. So in that sense, it's sort of kind of swallowed, it's taken up the whole pie for Coolio, whereas Dr. Dre still has a good 35 years of history to contend with that is still seen as like pretty relevant and vibrant and whatever. But yeah, like I remember when Rob Harvilla of The Ringer, you know, he does that's the 60 Songs That Define the 90s podcast. I think it was 30 at first. And he asked like a prompt tweet at some point during that the early podcast. And he said, yes, like what were the three songs you would use to define the 90s? And to me, the answers were Smells Like Teen Spirit, Nothing But a G Thing, and Third Song. And maybe that third song is Waterfalls or Baby One More Time or Friends in Low Places. But those are the only two lock songs, or Smells Like Teen Spirit and Nothing But a G Thing. But yeah, I don't know why totally the reputation hasn't kind of upheld the way it should have. Because like you say, it is a song that, I mean, it's maybe not relevant in the sense that most rap doesn't sound like this now. But obviously this everything that came from Nothing But a G Thing, you know, that timeline is sort of unbroken. And if you can trace it all back to Nothing But a G Thing, even if you don't necessarily hear those G-funk synths anymore, or you don't hear like, I don't know, like 1, 2, 3 into the 4 type openings. But for a good 4 to 5 years, this was the sound of popular music. And it's all because of this song, and it's all because of The Chronic.
For me, when I think of hip hop, it'll show my age, but like, this is what it sounds like to me. a lot of boom and a lot of bap and a lot of synthesizers. And
yes, it's the sound of the back dropping. Like, that's it. It's, I don't know. I have a question for you, Todd. But you haven't really answered the question, though. Which one is better?
Ooh.
Part of me wants to say Gangsta's Paradise just because that's the one that hasn't been taken yet. And it's like, is that fair? It's like, not fair. I could make a case for it. It's like, am I arguing for, G-Thing's legacy? Or am I saying which is the better song?
Well, it's song versus song, not legacy versus legacy.
Yeah.
You got to go with your heart here.
Okay, it's going to be Dre. It's going to, I'm putting my, it's going to be unanimous, which I feel like the kids today don't know. Like, Coolio disappeared after that and he's got like no competition. Also, he just kind of went away. He didn't age on screen the way Dre and Snoop did.
Yeah, well, especially you think about Snoop. When he recorded these tracks for Dre, he was 18. He was a child, which is wild. And it's weird because you go back and you watch that music video and you go, yep, he surely was. That surely is a teenager.
a child hidden lead off on the greatest rap song of all time. It's incredible.
You know, Snoop is really such a, I kind of feel like we should talk about Doggy Style 2 since it came out the following year and was also produced by Dre and has some like banger tracks. In fact, the thing that I kind of wanted to ask you about, Todd, was why it was that you pitted Gangsta's Paradise against Nothing But A G Thing, just because to me, from 92 when The Chronic dropped to 95 when Gangsta's Paradise came out, like, I mean, obviously this particular genre of rap was still pretty big, but like, it had moved, the needle had moved, things had changed, the way that people were, like, what kind of music people were listening to had shifted, I think, pretty considerably from 92 to 95. And this is not the song that I would have paired against Nothing But The G Thing. So I'm curious as to why you picked it.
I don't know. Like, they're just like so, I think you like greatly underestimate like how much people still love Gangsta's Paradise.
No, I don't. Because I don't personally like a song, and I am excited to hear what Unterberger has to say, because, you know, I often find myself changing my mind about things because somebody likes a thing in a way that I hadn't considered.
Like, there are two like songs in that stratosphere about being a gangsta, including everything that came after and everything that came around it. Like, these two are just like right at the top.
Right. Like you said, Nothing But A G Thing. And I thought for sure I was going to hear one of two other songs in response.
I have two songs too. I'm curious if they're the same too.
But okay. My two,
I may have
were,
put them against each other in a future episode, but like, go on.
Okay. So, and they both came out the following year. One is Cube's It Was a Good Day, and the other is, in fact, Gin and Juice.
I had Gin and Juice. I did not have It Was a Good Day. I think It Was a Good Day might actually be the best of the ones that either of us came up with. That's a great call.
What's the other one you had?
Well, if I was to talk about another kind of classic G-Funk two-hander, is there one song that kind of comes to mind there?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have Ice Cube up against it in a future episode.
Okay.
Assuming we're all talking about the same one, it's Regulate.
Regulate, yeah. I mean, I don't think it would have, I don't necessarily think it would have stood a chance in the poll. I'm not sure if Regulate still has the juice with your audience.
It's
like
fucking
that.
Better.
It should. It's one of the great. Also, like, I think nothing, if you got down to it, Nothing But A G Thing is probably a slightly better song, but there's a real argument to be had there. Regulate is just, is Nothing But A G Thing after dark, basically. They're sort of two flips of the same coin there.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, I just, the idea of pitting Dre against Cube post NWA feels really good to me. But I'll say this, as long as Cube comes back around, and only because, like, I thought about it, and then I thought also interesting that here we have the song that we are doing, which is a song that was created for a movie, and Cube did this really great song that lives on forever, but immediately after switched over to become a movie guy.
You know, we've named like five different songs here. Coolio versus all of them. Like, Coolio is definitely the odd man out because all the four other songs we mentioned are just like party songs. They're nothing but fun times. They're nothing but good times. And Gangsta's Paradise is not like a party song, although you could play it at a party and people would have a good time, but
Up against Murder Was the Case. I look up at the sky.
it is funny to think about that of all these songs we're mentioning, this is by far the most serious, most dour, most kind of dark sounding one. It was also by far the biggest hit of the four in the real time. Like, it, this
absolutely.
Was the, this is the only one of the songs we talked about that went to number one on the Hot 100. It was the number one song of all of 1995 on the Hot 100.
G-Thang got shut out by Informer.
But Snow was in jail at the time. Respect to Snow. He was a real one, too. but yeah, it's sort of insane to think about. This is a pretty uncommercial song. And yet, you know, we're talking about all these sort of all-time party classics, kind of feel-good classics. Some of them have darkness to them, too, obviously. But, like, it's crazy that Gangsta's Paradise is the one that still that has over a billion Spotify plays now. It was both the biggest hit at the time, and it's the most enduring popular favorite, despite being a weird, creepy fucking song.
Yeah, I was, you know, a very sheltered child, so I was not supposed to know any of these songs. I'd get in trouble. I definitely knew Gangsta's Paradise. I did not know G-Thang. I did know Gin and Juice.
Gin and Juice slaps, too. What a great track.
Oh. that would have also been a great one. Yeah, yeah.
Smoking and...
So... I kind of wonder if that darkness isn't why Gangsta's Paradise hasn't lived so much. Because it feels like there's, I don't want to say more of an edge to it, because G-Thang is like a very mean song.
Well, the Chronic is the meanest and best breakup album of all time.
The other funny thing about Gangsta, and one of the sort of sneaky reasons maybe why it did have this sort of four quadrant appeal that's kind of continued to this day, there's no cursing in it. And then that was a specific, I mean, we'll talk more about the reasons behind that later. But it, despite being a dark song, despite being a song about some pretty weighty topics, it's also a family friendly song. So that helped, you know, that's probably maybe one of the reasons why my brother was able to own a copy of it when he was, you know, 12, and why I was able to listen to that as a teenager. But, you know, maybe my parents would have looked askance at him buying The Chronic.
I would never have guessed until if it hadn't been pointed out to me that there is no radio edit of Gangsta's Paradise.
You would expect it, right?
Yeah. It's so...
Like every time he says the word fool, much like any Dre song where you hear that on the radio cut, you're like, that's the N-word, right? Like, that's just the N-word on the actual track. But no.
And it doesn't necessarily suffer for it either. Like, it doesn't feel like an edited song, even though it is toned down for that reason. Like, I, at least growing up, you know, obviously as a 10-year-old, you have different standards for these things. But I never thought, like, man, Coolio really like kind of pulled his punches on that one. It feels like he's saying what he wants to be saying, just doing it clean.
He says fool like it's a curse word. He 100%. Says it, and there is like power behind it. I don't know. There's like a moralism to it that, again, it's just like, how did you get away with this? How did you get away with like being so, like, this is like almost a preachy song. On paper, at least, no one thinks of it that way. It isn't one.
Well, the cool thing about it, I think, because you're right, it does kind of have that preachy quality to it, and certainly the movie that it's associated with, which will is not helping its case in that respect. But it's not preachy in that it's all about him. You know, it's a first person song. It's not saying like stay in school, kids. It's saying like I'm worried I'm not going to live to see 25. You know, or 24 specifically.
Yeah,
like, he keeps it personal. Even though he says it's not based on a true story, but he does make it personal in a way that doesn't make it feel like he's trying to, you know, be an after school special. It just feels like he's kind of talking about real stuff that's going on with him and the people he knows.
Yeah.
That music video is so weird, though.
Hold on. I'm going to turn my chair around backwards.
There you go. What's this all about?
You want to tell me what this is all about?
Yeah. It's just such a weird thing. Like, Ishima just sit down with like a little bobby hat and be like, whoa, what's all this then? Very, very strange. And also, having watched Dangerous Minds.
Did you watch it? I watched it today.
So it was. This is a very quick cutaway to something else. But I was out before I came back to do this and watch the movie and do the last little bit of research. But we were talking about ChatGPT and its influence on schools and like how teachers are dealing with essays and stuff like that. I was like, you know, it's interesting. Like, they're like talking about how they're having a hard time getting through to these kids. I was like, as it happens, I'm actually about to go home and watch a little film called Dangerous Minds. And somebody said immediately after, wow, great movie. And I was like, is it? It was such a weird moment. And I thought, everything I know is wrong. because that is not what I remember thinking about Dangerous Minds. And upon reflection, after having watched it today again, I was like, yeah, it's no, it's, I would probably be more likely to watch the Edward James Olmos version or Lean on Me or any one of a myriad other films that kind of have the same vibe.
No one told me that Michelle Pfeiffer does that whole movie in like a Sally Field and Steel Magnolias Southern accent. Like,
oof. It does not help the film.
I watched the first hour this morning. I intended to watch the rest. I got sidetracked. But yeah, I think the best thing you can say about the movie is that it gets the song out of the way like right away. and like the whole
we know
song
what you're here
pretty
for.
Much. Yeah.
It shows up like three times, I think, in the film.
Does it?
It
okay.
really is. It's like a real rule of three. It shows up a couple of times. That movie sure is something. There were things that I found out when I looked it up. So first of all, I had no idea that it was based on a book. Did you know this?
Because I looked it up after, but yeah, I didn't know that before.
So like the name of the character is the name of the person who wrote the book. The thing that really blew my mind about it, I don't know why, it's not like things don't change in films for dramatic effect, but there's a character in the film that like she's got to get through to in order to get through to the other kids. And he, in the film, is killed by a crackhead. Now, a fun fact is, based on a real person, that guy, not dead. Joined the Marines, married, two kids, happily alive to this day. I thought, wild, absolutely wild.
Would not have seen that coming based on the first half of the movie. That's very strange.
Here's an amazing thing. He wrote it for Bad Boys, which is a very different movie.
I don't think he wrote it specifically for Bad Boys. I think he wrote it, or he and LV, whose contributions we should definitely talk about at some point. They wrote it, and I think Coolio's team tried to pitch it around to movies, and the first movie they tried was Bad Boys. But it wasn't like he wrote it like picturing like Martin Lawrence and Will Smith car chases in Miami necessarily. But I think they just tried it because, you know, these movies have insane soundtracks, and especially in the mid-90s. They hope they could get a place there. It didn't work out. Dangerous Minds ended up instead. So that definitely makes more sense than Bad Boys. That's for damn sure.
I feel like it could have made sense in both. It's the duality of this song.
Mm.
And the weird thing about it is also that Coolio never wrote anything like that before or since. Like, to the rest of his days, like, he had this one song which is like completely not like the rest of his catalog.
Maybe he should have written more.
The people backing him were really afraid of that track. They were nervous, weren't they? That was like the big thing that I remember. Is that he had done this track and they thought, oh, this will be bad for him because he's like the slide, slide, slippity slide guy, you know, like it's
a fair point.
Like very out of what you'd expect from him. And then it ended up being by far his biggest hit.
I like that song. That's a good song.
What, Fantastic Voyage?
I was actually talking about Gangsta's Paradise, but yes, Fantastic Voyage fucking rules. I love that fucking song. I think I love that one more. Certainly,
yes.
Before I loved Gangsta's Paradise, and I kind of liked 1, 2, 3, 4. That's a good song.
Yeah, that's
ooh,
the one.
La la do wa diddy. He's got a lot of jams that people don't remember anymore, and then See You When You Get There, which is not a jam, which has been rightly forgotten.
Let's switch over for a second.
Yeah.
I would like Andrew for you to talk about The Chronic, talk about that period that sort of led to the album, and then sort of this handover from 92 to 93 and how much the shape of music was changed by this album.
The year is 1992. Okay. Biggest names in music are Arrested Development, The Far Side, Tribe Called Quest. There are other things going on also.
It is really interesting when you listen to and then this album, I think, comes out like close to the end of 1992. So the impact of The Chronic and its singles aren't really felt until the next year. But you look at 92 and it's the stuff that Todd mentions. It's a lot of kind of like alternative rap or conscious rap, if you want to call it that. It's a lot of kind of pop rap, like stuff like, you know, Criss Cross and Rex and Effects and things like that.
First rap record owned, Rex and Effect.
Every time Rex and Effects comes out, you got to mention.
It's important that I embarrass myself every time.
Fair enough. But yeah, the West Coast is not necessarily a huge player in the game commercially at that point. I mean, Cypress Hill is doing their thing, and NWA is just released their second album, second or third, depending on how you define it. But I can't necessarily say on this podcast. But it was a huge hit, but it didn't really have an impact on popular culture. It was more just kind of based on the success that they had had out of Straight Outta Compton. and it was a very dark and nasty album, and didn't have any hits on it, and just kind of left people with a sour taste, I think, for the most part. Dre kind of splits from the group, does his own thing on Interscope, and starts Death Row, and then this sort of G-Funk sound materializes, and it's not really like anything I don't think that had been in rap music before, at least not in sort of this kind of grand scale blockbuster fashion. And it just sort of takes over. And for the next kind of 3 to 4 years after that, the entire direction of hip hop changes, and West Coast becomes sort of the center of the rap world again, California and LA specifically. And the sound of G-Funk, those sort of whiny synths and the very kind of laid back beats and the very catchy hooks, and the sort of the very like pro chronic and pro smoking and sort of just laid back California lifestyle stuff mixed with, you know, obviously very, very R-rated gangster violence, that becomes the thing. And within a couple of years, like Madonna and George Michael are releasing G-Funk singles to a certain extent. Like there's a lot of
synths going on in 92, 93, 94.
100%. And not only does it impact rap, but it impacts kind of rap's place in popular culture, and it becomes a bigger part of the pie. And, you know, obviously Snoop follows the next year, and Doggy Style is an even bigger album than The Chronic. And by the end of the decade, basically, like, rap is the biggest music in the world, or at least on par with pop and rock, in large part because of what The Chronic started 7 years earlier. But it all kind of starts with Nothing But a G Thing. Like, that's the first kind of single out of the gate. They had done, Dre and Snoop had done Deep Cover the year before, the title theme for the movie Deep Cover, which was a little bit closer to the sort of NWA, kind of what they were doing at the end of their career.
1-8-7 on a motherfucking cop.
Fucking great song, by the way. Absolute classic. Deserves a bigger rep than it has. You know, I'm sure the West Coast, they appreciate it properly.
I don't think it's even on. I think that's not on Spotify, which probably has an impact on it.
Yeah, it wasn't as of a year ago. But again, like a very, very sort of nasty, very, you know, dark sounding song. This song is not dark sounding in the slightest. I mean, it's got some, you know, there's some violence in it. Certainly there's some threats in it. There's some violence against women, which is never far removed from the Dr. Dre experience. But it's a very sunny, bright, you know, like the video starts at like early in the morning. Like you can see this, like it starts at sunrise basically. And it kind of takes you through a day in the life of Dr. Dre, supposedly at the time, you know, a sort of a very unambitious version of himself, but it's directed by him. It's definitely the image he wanted to point to sort of portray to the world, of just, you know, an average guy sort of, you know, down on his luck financially and doesn't really have great prospects. And is sort of mixed up in the world of gangster violence, but is also, you know, living life and, you know, driving his lowrider and going to barbecues and, you know, spraying snooty girls with 40s at the end of the video. And
it's one of the greatest videos of all time. Like,
yeah,
everything just looks so fun in that.
And that becomes the image. And this is what we grew up with thinking of as what like a rap music video looks like. This is what a rap song sounds like. And I don't know if it still gets that sort of respect from a lot of people, but yeah, to me, it'll always be the gold standard.
I think it's just the reason why I like it so much is that both the song and the corresponding video are a snapshot, yeah. Right? Like, I don't see, conversely, Gangsta's Paradise in that way at all. Like, I look forward to hearing counter arguments to that. But the thing about, again, that whole record in its entirety, but especially just watching that music video, was that it felt like it captured the fact that, like, yes, they experienced violence, poverty, whatever, but that did not somehow disrupt or deny the overall joy of being alive. It was just a part of the soup. And the thing that really got me, my favorite part of that video always, is that little, like, 2-year-old kid.
Oh, God, yeah.
Just grooving to the tune. You're like, that's it. Like, that really kind of captures it, right? Like, it's just a snapshot of 92. So perfect. And that's,
by the way,
thing,
the video credits, the director is Andre Young. Like, I was like, oh, I wonder who that guy is. Like, it took me until like I was in my mid late 20s before I realized it was
the
actually
esteemed
Dr.
Young. I watch that video now and I think it's like, wow, this is like a happy community. It's like, I haven't seen that many people together for like 3 years.
Huh, that's weird. What a weirdly specific amount of time, Todd.
Yeah. No, I was like, this is like a neighborhood where everyone is friends. It's like very almost nostalgic, really. Like, remember the good old days?
And that's kind of baked into the music, too, because it's got the G-Funk samples. You know, in this case, it's a Leon Haywood's I Want to Do Something Freaky to You, which is also a great song, by the way. But almost all of the best songs on The Chronic do have those kind of 70s P-Funk era samples that, you know, for people of that age, they didn't mean anything to me at the time, but the people of that age, I'm sure it does kind of feel like, you know, down home cooking and block parties and just like all the good memories that you have of your life. And that's sort of what this video is too.
Yeah. By the way, I'm going to call bullshit on the Straight Outta Compton movie where it shows him like composing the riff to Nothing But a G Thing. Like Dr. Dre is sitting there. He's like tooling around. I was like, there, that's the riff. It's a sample. It's a sample, you bullshitter.
It is quite literally a sample.
I think he does replay that. That riff never appears exactly. I mean, I think the melody does, but the riff itself isn't, I think, is recreated as opposed to sampled. But you're right.
He didn't
just pick it out of the air as like random inspiration. Yeah. He heard it in the Leon Haywood song. Yeah.
He's like, you're a genius, Dre.
You can see Dre like wrote that scene in the movie actually. And he wrote it in front of Leon Haywood as Leon Haywood wept. this is perhaps another bold statement, but, I think that Leon Haywood song is better than the Stevie song.
Okay.
That's not one of my favorite Stevie Wonder songs.
No, me neither.
That they sampled off of Gangsta's Paradise.
I don't know. Songs from the Key of Life was one of the first records I bought. I think it was definitely the first Stevie album I bought. And when I was like first heard Pastime Paradise, I was like, whoa, I'd never heard that song before. And I was like, wow, this is vastly improved by Coolio.
Yes, it is.
I feel bad saying that about a Stevie Wonder song, especially one on that album, but you're sort of, I mean, like it's the right kind of song to sample because it's a song that has cool parts, but there's room for improvement, right? Like,
yeah.
Like you don't hear that song and think, oh, this is like a complete product that can never be adjusted or changed or improved in any way. It's like, oh, man, it's kind of a cool hook, kind of an interesting string arrangement. Like I would love to hear that in another context maybe. And kudos to Coolio and LB for pulling it off.
I mean, yeah, it feels a little unfinished, and mostly what they do is add a lot of muscle to it. And they add LV, who we're going to mention, we forgot.
Oh, we'll get to him. We'll get to him. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we're, it's just like, how, like, what do you even
like I
include
said, like,
or not include about the Chronic as a moment in music? Because it really, I don't know that there's a way to oversell its importance, just because maybe due to it being on and off of Spotify and also Dre kind of being in some ways overshadowed by Snoop and then later by Eminem, and the fact that he doesn't have the best reputation as a human being.
I'll tell you what's done it. It's that Snoop has become the Snoop we know now. The kids don't know. Like I had one person tell me he thought that Snoop was like a fictional character from commercials, like the Dos Equis guy.
the only reason my mind isn't blown right now is because I've heard you say this before, but it's pretty fucking wild. Let me tell you,
that's absolutely the wildest thing I can imagine. And yet, yeah, for me, because I would have been 12 when the album came out, and seeing Dre Day and then Nothing But a G Thing, like. I don't know. Snoop lives so large in the cultural consciousness, but no matter how big he gets and no matter how Martha Stewart he goes, in my mind, he is that 18-year-old that I saw in that music video. He's always going to be that guy.
Let me ask both of you something, because especially in recent years, but I think this has always sort of been the case. Dr. Dre kind of gets a rap as like he's a brilliant producer. He's a great, you know, exec. He's one of the most important figures in hip hop history, but he's a bad rapper. I never totally agreed with that. Like, I understand where it's coming from. There's a sort of bluntness to his delivery that is not particularly graceful or dexterous or whatever. Like, he's definitely not a rapper that anybody would choose to emulate. But there's also kind of like a forcefulness to it that still kind of resonates with me. And like, there's certain lines in the song and just him going like, yeah. Like I don't feel like anybody else would do it quite as well. What do you guys think of Dre as a rapper? Yeah.
I completely agree with your sentiment, and I would say that the thing about Dre that makes him a weak rapper is that he's always been a hard sell for me on his own.
Mm.
The thing that makes Nothing But a G Thing great is that he and Snoop play off of each other so well. It's that smoothness that Snoop has as a perfect counterpoint to the sort of harsh and forcefulness to the way that Dre raps. That's the thing that makes it work.
But Let Me Ride is a great single, too. It doesn't quite have the rap.
It's very good.
But you're right that obviously the Snoop takes it to a whole other level in this song, and certainly no one would confuse the two for their reputations based on it.
Dre, well, welcome back to the show, Dre. We've covered him before, and that was the California Love versus Mo Money, Mo Problems thing. And like during that, I think I feel like I really started to appreciate how good Dre is as a rapper, and especially his delivery, because we were comparing him to Puffy, who is legitimately just a bad rapper. He's bad. Yes. He's very bad. I feel like you're going to object to that, Andrew. You got a look on your face.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to stick up for, like, he's not in my top 10 or whatever. He got the job done is all I can really say. He's a utilitarian rapper, and there's a certain charisma to him. I actually think he's at his best as a rapper when he's just kind of providing ad-libs on, like, the best Notorious B.I.G. singles. Like, tell your friends, they can get with my friends, we can be friends. Like, that's great, but I don't necessarily need to listen to him for all and No Way Out, I guess. That's fair.
Yeah.
I think it was the moment that he was on the Godzilla soundtrack sampling Kashmir that I turned against him and was never, ever going to be in his favor ever again.
That's fair.
Dre, by comparison, like, maybe he's not, like, a guy with, a lot of finesse, but every word he says, you remember. I've heard Mo Money, Mo Problems so many times in my life. I cannot think of any lines from that second verse. I don't remember what Puffy says or how he says it. I think he says we won't stop at some point, but that's about it. Like, versus, like, just like you, I can rap nothing but a G thing with my eyes closed. I don't know. That has to count for something. Like, when Dre says something, you hear it. So I think he's always been a little underrated as far as that goes. People say his stuff is ghostwritten. People say it. I don't even know why I'm hedging that people say that, but that's why
it's almost certainly true. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. That's what I'd always heard. That's why Dre doesn't get much respect as a rapper. I mean, neither does Snoop anymore. So, and Snoop has gone on records like, yes, I have people write for me now. Who cares?
He's got a little bit more force of personality, I guess, than Dre does. You never question where it's coming from with Snoop, even if somebody else technically wrote the words.
I have a question, and it is a matter of a weirdness in the lyrics here. It is the phrase "Death Row is the label that pays me." Here's why I think that's weird. It's just not really like that much of a positive in my mind. That's like being
it
like,
was at the time.
I'm on this track because I like Death Row is the label that gives me this money, so that's the reason that I'm on this track. Yeah.
I don't know, but Death Row was cool at the time, or at least they were trying to make it cool.
There's certainly a lot of stories around what was happening. I don't know how cool Suge Knight is as a human being. He certainly did some stuff that helped Dre out at the time, most assuredly. However, I don't know that I would call his behavior cool in 2023.
I'm not saying, I don't mean good. I mean cool. Did I say good? Many bad things are cool by the standards of the day.
All right. That's fair enough.
Also, if we want to say, you know, positive things, like on a moral level, let's give it up for safe sex advocate Snoop Dogg.
Hell yeah.
Great use of the word lieutenant in that verse as well. Yeah. I don't know where he picked that one out of the air, but beautiful moment.
Oh, it's genius. Like I said, the kids don't know. They don't know that Snoop Dogg was like a legitimately dangerous man for like many years into his career. Even like
he was fighting that rap case, the murder case for a really long time. For years, he was fighting it.
Most dangerous man in America at one point. I think it was called.
Yeah, like there was crazy, like my favorite. Snoop paraphernalia is like some UK tabloid that was trying to get him evicted from the country. It's like, ban this sick filth next to a picture of Snoop Doggy Dog.
Did not see the days of him, you know, hanging out with Martha Stewart and co-starring on Monk. And
when did Snoop officially become the wise old man Snoop? Like, when was he officially...
Slightly before the Snoop Lion era, I feel. I think
He's been on his way for a while, though. I think it's been a 30-year journey, and maybe about 10 years into that is where the transition started to happen. I mean, once he got off No Limit Records, I think that was sort of the end of of Snoop as sort of the hardened street hustler, and then after that it's him doing jams with the Neptunes and fucking around with auto tune and just having a good time, kind of.
Even as late as like Drop It Like It's Hot, he's still like making gang references and stuff.
It's true, and I think he still does. He still does feel the difference, but yeah, it's not quite the same. Not with the same kind of malice behind it, perhaps, or at least not the same perceived malice. It was probably never really that much malice to begin with.
Yeah, that's the thing. He really has never felt particularly malicious. In hindsight, you look back and you're like, how did people ever feel this way about him?
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. Anyway, all right, now I want to talk about 1995.
All right.
Unterberger, what was the rap game like in 95?
I can't believe I get to be a historian for this. I'll say,
We know you'll have the answer.
95, I mean, things had kind of gone sideways between Dre and Death Row to a certain extent, I think, already, but that was going to get about to get a whole lot worse. Tupac was sort of on top of the world, not necessarily in his personal life, but he had kind of taken over as the avatar of West Coast rap by that point. Coolio, I mean, we talked about it a little bit. Like, he had also had one very big G-Funk hit in Fantastic Voyage, and that was almost like me. I think it kind of made him seem at least like the MC Hammer of this moment, because like it was a very big pop hit and people didn't necessarily know about Coolio's Street Bonafides the same way that they knew about Dre and Snoop's. But he's legit too. I mean, he goes back to LA and he was in a really good group called, I think, WC and the Mad Circle that had a couple of really good albums in the very early 90s that get the kind of old heads respect, but didn't really have crossover hits. And, even on It Takes a Thief, the other single off that album I remember was a lot more, it wasn't hard, but it was a lot more thoughtful. It was definitely not like a party, good time starter in the same way the Fantastic Voyage was. But, G-Funk was still huge, but it was sort of in a different place by that point, to the place where, again, Madonna has a G-Funk influence single and it's sort of been co-opted by the mainstream. And this song, there are G-Funk elements to it, but it's also kind of its own thing. And I don't even necessarily know where to talk about the precedent for where this song comes from. I don't know. I'm curious if you guys can think of anything, but it sort of has its own space, right? Like it's sort of a 101 in the mid 90s. And I think what you see of it much more of is as a soundtrack single. Like that's which is much more representative of that as a mid 90s trend than it is of G-Funk, because 1995 was sort of the commercial peak for when every big movie had to have a soundtrack. It's when the Batman Forever soundtrack it becomes like the first one to have its own website and the first to have like the kind of from and inspired by rather than
from and inspired. Like, that's what I remember about Batman Forever.
Yeah. And there's a million huge soundtracks that come out this year, from Clueless to Kids to, stuff like New Jersey Drive and Mallrats, movies that aren't necessarily that memorable as movies and definitely aren't remembered that well 30 years later. But the soundtrack still endured because that was such an emphasis at the time. Like you had to have the big lead single.
Exhale. That's another one.
Waiting to Exhale. That might be the best one. It might be the biggest one too. But you had to have like eight artists that were big at the time, and you had to have one kind of undeniable knockout to sort of lead with. And this, I don't even know if we're still talking about Dangerous Minds in any capacity in 2023. If it wasn't for Gangsta
God
Paradise.
No, God no. Like the only thing people know about Dangerous Minds is stuff they know from the music video.
Yeah, like that is the movie, I think, in a lot of people's memory. It certainly is in my memory. Like that the scene with Michelle Pfeiffer. I think if you ask people to describe a scene from Dangerous Minds, they'd be like, oh, Michelle Pfeiffer comes into a room, she turns the chair around and she sits dramatically and she asks a student if you want to tell me what this is all about. Like that's the memory of that movie.
In my memory, like if I had to guess, I've never seen it before a couple days ago, like I would have assumed Coolio was in the movie. Like he was in there
maybe
playing.
I didn't watch the whole thing. Yeah.
You know what's amazing about the music video versus the movie is not just that like it's totally different, but that it's also much darker and gives the vibe, because even when they take the clips, they make the clips from the movie have the same color saturation.
Yeah, darker. Yeah.
It's visually a darker piece. And so if you had just seen the music video, you would assume that the film has that quality to it. In point of fact, the film is quite brightly lit. I'm not saying there isn't dark stuff tonally in there, but like it's shot like it's about kids going to school. So it's very, very weird.
I don't know. Like I remember someone saying that like Superfly, the soundtrack, is what Superfly the movie should have been. Like it sells the idea of it much more than the actual movie does if you actually watch it. And that's what I feel about Gangsta's Paradise. It is a much better movie than the actual movie.
Yeah, that movie is bad. I can't figure out what the transition was of how we particularly arrived to that song coming out and its popularity. What's weird is that for some reason I always think about it in Congress with Bone Thugs and Harmony Crossroads, which came out like a year later, and I couldn't even tell you why. But for some reason, those two songs are very linked in my head.
I understand that, even though I don't necessarily have a great reason for why, too, but they're two sort of singularly dark and, I guess, death-obsessed songs that came out around both in the mid-90s, and both were gigantic Hot 100 number one hits. And so also, like, Bone Thugs had a much, I would say, a much longer and more storied career than Coolio, but I bet you if you ask not real rap fans, but like very casual rap fans to name one Bone Thugs song, that's probably the one. And they might not have a second one.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out what else is in the lead up, right? Because I brought up Murder Was the Case as part of this.
Murder Was the Case also
feels like that, right? And that's mm-hmm. and that's off of that first Nuke record.
We could talk about like hardcore stuff a little bit, like stuff like Gravediggers that has that same sort of gothic element to it, where you know, choirs in the background and very, very menacing synths and such. So there's a little bit of that in Gangsta's Paradise, but again, that was kind of going for a much more specific vibe and a much more, I don't know, much less cinematic one or a different kind of cinematic, you know, a horror movie as opposed to a gritty urban drama, I guess. And this isn't really the same thing.
You said it's like one of one. There isn't another Gangsta's Paradise. I didn't think of the Crossroads, but that really does seem to be like the closest, because they are both gangsta songs that aren't necessarily offensive if you're like a prude. Like there's the moralism of Gangsta's Paradise and the sadness of Bone Thugs. Like the Gangsta's Paradise is a song with consequences in it, which Nothing But a G Thing is very much not.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing that I never liked about that song, or certainly now when I listen to it, it just feels like a kind of like snooty moralism that I have no interest in. But the thing that you had alluded to towards the very beginning, that was that the reason why there are no curse words is in fact Stevie Wonder. They wanted that track, they wanted to use it, and he said no unless they cleaned it up, and so they did. And in point of fact, it worked so well that what year was it? They like went on the Billboard Awards, and Stevie Wonder came out and like sang with them, and they did an extended version. I think it was actually 95. It was like same year, but
it was either 95 or 96.
That's a pretty big moment to have Stevie Wonder actually come out and do the track. I mean, he also came out and did Wild Wild West, but, you know, that being said,
he's a friend to the next generation, Stevie Wonder. He's willing to extend an arm. I should also say that the Stevie Wonder connection / sample interpolation is also the reason why it wasn't nominated for the Oscar, which probably would have won otherwise. But yeah, you can't be eligible for an Oscar if you have previously written material.
Oscar was so stupid.
Yeah, it's kind of dumb. But that could have.
But it did in fact win awards. It's not as though it won nothing.
Yeah, I didn't realize that Stevie Wonder was like actually came on there with like the full endorsement rather than just the sample. Like that feels like a really big deal to me, because a lot of those like old school R&B people were not down with hip hop for a very long time. Like Prince has a song about how much he hates hip hop.
Yeah, I don't remember this in real time, so I couldn't say what kind of like how it felt in the moment. But certainly, like it is a big moment for the song, and it's a big moment for that sort of generational divide. And look, the 70s and 90s had a lot to say to one another at this time period. So it makes sense, really.
Yeah.
So before we get into category stuff, can I do my quick rundown of the greatest of all times for Nothing But a G Thing? All right, thank you.
Yes.
So, pretty inarguable to start with a greatest synth hook in rap history. Sort of, you agreed on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
There was much competition though.
Sure, but I think this is still the preeminent one. Greatest opening lines in hip hop history. One, two, three.
Yeah. Gangsta's Paradise is up there.
It's a good one, but there's a little cheesiness to the Gangsta's Paradise opening that there is.
I mean, you're arguing for 1, 2, 3 into the four.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that I would agree to that.
Really?
It's pretty good, but I don't think that I would, the best? I don't know. Look, man, all I know is that mom cooked the breakfast with no hog.
That's not an opening line.
I know, but it's such a good, anyway, sorry.
I had greatest label shout in hip hop history. It sounds like Lena disagrees with that, but Death Row's label that pays me, I think that's number one.
I don't know. I'd have to think about it.
Greatest verse handoff in hip hop history. I think as a two hander, regulate on a hole might be better. But so Dre, what up, dog? You got to give him what you want. What's that like? That and how they kind of switch his hands in the third verse from Snoop to Dre at that point. That's fantastic. I don't think you're gonna ever see a better one than that.
I mean, not since Run DMC, just constantly handed it back and forth.
Sure, or Beastie Boys doing it within the same line. Yeah. I guess. Yeah, that's
yeah.
Fair.
Like to me, like, but that's in my head very like. I don't know. That's an 80s vibe and very different, whereas this thing that you're describing is far more, despite Dre, very fluid, right? Like, there's just something so beautiful, naturalistic, just like the music video, that it captures a moment that feels utterly and completely real, right? It doesn't feel somehow faked or practiced, rehearsed. It just feels like a conversation.
My favorite handoff is between Q-Tip and Busta Rhymes on Scenario, actually.
Oh, okay. All right. That is okay. Also pretty good.
That's fair. Greatest music video in hip hop history? Oof. I would say so.
I don't know. Ooh.
I really.
That's the greatest genre for music.
That's a very broad indisputably category. So
yeah, I don't know, man.
I think it's certainly in the conversation. I haven't made a list, but like it would be one of the first I came up with.
Sure. Greatest radio edit in hip hop history, just kind of throughout. It's one of the few songs from that period that even though like it feels like it should be kind of neutered by a radio edit, and maybe it's just me saying it because I grew up with a radio edit, to me it still feels like the same song even in radio edit form, which is really, really tough to do.
I don't know if I've ever heard the radio edit.
Sure, I'm sure you have, because if you've seen the music video,
yeah,
you've heard the radio edit.
I don't know, like I immediately turn it off and put on the real song.
I'm going to tell you something. I actually, not only do I agree with that, but I actually think just generally speaking, The Chronic, because I like Dre Day quite a bit, and I like a lot of tracks off that album that were singles. I actually think just period, as far as radio cuts where they make stuff changed and you feel like the song would somehow be so neutered as to be bad, I would say that it's an excellent, perfect execution. If you have to neuter something, I don't think you could do it any better than they did. So I agree with that 100%.
All right, well, thank you for support on that one, Lena. Two more. Greatest sequel song in hip hop history, and that it has the greatest sequel in the next episode.
That's I can't even think of like anything else in the conversation.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what else would you even talk about?
And what a great teaser to like leave off for another 7 years. Like, no, just wait for it. It's going to be worth it. And it fucking was.
It was.
Yeah, unbelievable. Shout out to the next episode. Also one of the greatest songs in hip hop history. And the last one, and to me, maybe the most important one, and the one that I think y'all are going to have the easiest time agreeing with, greatest use of vibra slap in hip hop history.
Yes. 100%. 100%.
For those at home unfamiliar, that's the thing you hit at the beginning of the song and it makes that kind of bouncy brrrr sound. Like, think of Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter or All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix. It's the one part of that intro that isn't taken from the Leon Haywood song. It's added by Dre and it puts the song instantly on a totally different level. Just fucking classic.
You know, I've never noticed that vibra slap before. I just had to pull it up. It's like, oh, there it is.
Well, you can go watch the music video and then you can kill two birds with one stone on the vibra slap and the radio edit. So yeah, that's my whole list. I don't know if y'all have any others, but that's a pretty good start, I think.
No, I feel like that's it.
I think we got to get to the categories.
Yes,
the
we questions. Have talked a lot.
Thank you for indulging me on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. All right. So after we talk, we do these four questions to hopefully make sense of all the talk. The first question is, one of these songs is going to stick around and the other one is going to disappear like it never existed in the first place. For the culture Unterberger, which of these songs has to stay?
Can we fast forward past this question in today?
Like, no, I think we actually.
I think it's gonna be an easy one. Yeah.
All right. Great.
We all agree that, and like I said, Gangsta's Paradise has like a humongous shadow.
We lose 40% of the last 30 years of music history without Nothing But a G Thing. It's like
the most awful thing I'll say is that the only argument that I would make in favor of Gangsta's Paradise is that without that, I lose Amish Paradise.
We made
it. I cannot believe we made it an hour into this podcast without talking about Amish Paradise. 100%.
You know, I
know. As you know, it is. I just haven't had my Twinkie Wiener sandwich.
As I learn more and more about Gangsta's Paradise, I also started to get offended the way Coolio did in 1996. It's like, no, this song is so much more than the Weird Al parody. And God, I know what our fans care about more.
You got to give them what they want, Todd.
What's
you
that?
Know? You got churn butter once or twice. You know, you raise a barn, so you raise another. Anyway, all right. We all agree it's nothing that you think. Question number two is a question of sort of like the lead up, the entire history of a song. You could be a fly on the wall. You can experience soup to nuts, everything, including the music video, the creation of one and only one of these two songs. What's the one that you want to see how the sausage got made the most?
Well, gosh, I sure would love to see Dr. Dre in the studio figuring out that riff off the top of his head.
Genius.
But do we get, I think if we include Suge getting Dre out of his contract as a part of this, then 100% it's that.
Dr. Dre and Snoop are like legendary personalities, and like everything, like they are like bigger than their music. And they're like, obviously the ones you would want to know more about because they're such, you know, important figures. On the other hand, they're like so overexposed at this point. Like they are writ into pop legend at this point. It's like, maybe there's all sorts of shit about Coolio we never knew. Who knows?
That's true. That's
maybe
true.
It's like, how did he put his hair up every morning, or did he just go to bed like that? Who knows?
Is that your official answer there, Todd? Or
I would probably go with G-Thang.
Yeah, I'm tempted to give this one to Coolio just because I'm not sure if he's going to get another one from me in these categories. But I mean, one of the ultimate sort of party atmosphere songs, you got to sort of feel like there'd be that energy in the studio. You kind of want to feel what that was like. But then with the personalities involved and some of the behind the scenes figures there, too, it might have been a very, very bad hang, in fact. So I think you can sort of guarantee an interesting story to the recording of Nothing But a G-Thang, and who knows what was going on with Gangsta's Paradise. I will give this one to Gangsta's Paradise, though, just because I feel like there's more about the song's actual composition that I'd want to find out about, more where I'd want to kind of know about what decisions they made here and there and why they decided to use this part of the Stevie song but not that part, or how Coolio interacted with LV. And yeah, it's sort of like, I mean, I'm making excuses here, but it is sort of like Todd said, that we just don't know the story behind this song the same way we know the story behind everything associated with Death Row and Dre and Snoop in the last 35 years.
That's a fair point. And I think, you know, I mean, what I know about LV is that after the fact, he and Coolio had a little bit of a falling out because Coolio, I guess, didn't want to pay him the amount that LV wanted to be paid to go out on tour. So he just went off and just did stuff with anybody else. Like, that's a really recent thing, I think, that he revealed just in the last couple of days.
Oh, that's a shame.
And I thought, that sucks. I mean, like, I have no opinion on this. This is none of my business whatsoever. But if I were LV, I probably would be pretty bummed about that as a situation, because he does add quite a bit to the track. Let's be honest.
Oh, yeah. I will always think of that bit in I Love the 90s where they say that he looked like the wind.
Still true, by the way. I also have that association. I watched the video today, and it's an accurate analogy.
Hey, off the top of you guys' heads, you both of you might know this, I guess, but what does LV stand for?
I looked this up earlier, and I do not remember what the answer is.
Yes, I also have forgotten.
LV stands for Large Variety.
Ladies love large variety.
Ladies love large variety. Anyway, all right, let's get to what for this round might be the most important question. Question number three, Megan Thee Stallion going to get up to a night of hot girl shit. She's putting out a playlist to get ready for said night of hot girl shit. One and only one, good God, if these two songs could go on that playlist for now and forever. Gentlemen, which one of these songs is hot girl shit?
Does anybody want to try to make the case for Gangsta's Paradise? It's going to be a losing argument. I feel like
Gangsta's Paradise, if you're gearing up for anything, is to smoke some fools, which can be hot girl shit.
That's true.
It could be.
That's as close as we're going to get on this one, I think.
And it's G-Thing. Again, G-Thing. Very, very quickly, unfortunately.
It's sad, though, and it makes me feel sad. Like, that makes me feel bad and wrong. Like, I shouldn't be doing this. But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely nothing but the G-Thing. All right.
Well, it makes you feel bad because this is the same guy who made Ain't No Fun If the Homies Can't Have None? Like, this is...
I don't know, on a plentitude of levels. Anyway, listen... Now, question number four, not just the most important question that we ask on this show, but the most important question ever asked by a human being. And in this case, using the radio cut, Todd. William Shatner, thespian, equestrian, magnificarian, I made up a word, singer, performer of songs in an actorly way. He's going to do a William Shatner version of one. And only one of these two songs. Which one must be shat upon, Todd?
I feel like he could do very good things with Gangsta's Paradise. Like, amazing things with Gangsta's Paradise. Again, it's got to be nothing but a G-Thing. The question is, which one is he, Dre or Snoop?
Well, the part that I want to hear the most is him doing the handoff. Like, kind of doing the both parts of, like, so, what up, dog? You know, like... Kind of like going back and forth on those two. That's the deal breaker for me.
We always default to if there's a second person, it's just Leonard Nimoy.
I feel like Nimoy is there. In my mind, Shatner is Dre, and Snoop is Martha Stewart.
I also have to say G-Thing. It's the appeal of him kind of doing the back and forth is too much for me. Even if it is with Nimoy instead of with himself, that's still too great for me to pass up.
I don't know. I would give it to Gangsta's Paradise personally, just because. Yeah, I think that like the fact that it's based on a movie or was meant to be a part of a movie and it fits so well for that one. I don't know.
I mean, here's what I'll say.
They should have had William Shatner play the Michelle Pfeiffer role in Dangerous Minds.
Definitely in the Gangsta's Paradise music video at the very least.
Absolutely. That would have been amazing. 10 out of 10, no notes if that had happened. As it is, Dangerous Minds, you know, a perfect film except for one thing. Michelle Pfeiffer's role should have been played by William Shatner.
I feel like I'm getting close to Gangsta's Paradise actually. It's like, if they can't understand it, how can they reach me? It's almost already a Shatner.
The question is, how much would he lean into the Fools? Could he also land the Fools with as much gravity as Coolio does?
It's William Shatner. Utz, yes, of course. How dare you even ask such a question?
Fair enough.
All right.
Why are we? It's a heavy dramatic role, Gangsta's Paradise.
I feel pretty strongly about it. All that being said, we are but three fools. Fool. Now it is time for the actual intellectuals, the listeners, to have their say. Todd, what do the listeners think?
All right. I am... like I said, I got a little offended. So if you said Amish Paradise in there, and that was your reason, I immediately deleted that from the readable comments. Like, and there were so many of them. That was like 70%. All right. Tanner McGuire writes, yet another opportunity for Todd and Lena to expose how white their audience truly is. We get the audience we deserve.
Here's the thing. I don't even think that's as true as it was 4+ years ago. I'd like to think that things have transformed. I feel like we have a wider audience, and maybe I was wrong in the first place. You know what? I'm going to say it. I think I was wrong from the jump. I think plenty of people of all kinds listen to this show, and thank you for listening. You should give us a dollar.
All right. Supa Dupa Jesus writes, every time I think of The Chronic, I think of the documentary Banging in Little Rock from the early 90s about a bunch of white kids in Arkansas pretending to be Crips. While Coolio did play a factor in that, that's 100% the impact of the DOGG.
I'd watch that.
I mean, I will say, like, it's such a weird, fascinating thing that The Chronic, again, the second rap album I bought, the first being that Rex and Effects record, growing up in the suburbs of New Jersey, Take a Drink, like, you wouldn't think that that was going to be a record that really spoke to me. However, Something that I think is really powerful about it is that between Dre and Snoop, it just somehow manages to speak across any type of, like, it doesn't matter who you are, right? You're going to listen to that and get something, right? And I was 12 years old. That's a time when you barely have any empathy at all. And yet, somehow they managed to reach through and make me feel what they were feeling. So I always think that, not to be too serious, but like, that's one of the greatest things about that record.
Absolutely. All right. Lucas writes, the first line of Gangsta's Paradise, as I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, borrows a line from Psalm 23. And the 150 Psalms in the Christian Bible were famously written by Snoop Dogg. So nothing but a G thing is the clear winner here.
Another great point.
Yes.
Some of them were written by Snoop Lion. I just want to be clear.
Oh, yeah. He did get his weird Christian-y phase. All right. Justin Alexander writes, Coolio, you know I ain't with that shit, Lieutenant. All right. Jazzy SPF writes, I'm going to bring up the fact that Gangsta's Paradise was in that first absolutely terrible trailer for the Sonic the Hedgehog movie. Oh, I'm not sure this has any bearing on my vote, but I just want y'all to suffer through remembering that trailer with me. That trailer was very
bad. The one with the teeth thing is that I remember. That's why I forgot that Gangsta's Paradise was there, because all I can remember is the teeth.
What a staggeringly bad decision.
Gangsta's Paradise was also just like a terrible choice for that trailer.
Like, that's what I meant by a staggering bad decision. Like there's only one movie that the song makes sense for, and is the one it was in. Like, we don't need to revisit that, I don't think.
Are you telling me that when you think of James Marsden, you don't think of Gangsta's Paradise
and Sonic the Hedgehog? I feel like I've seen it in a lot of movies recently.
Really?
Yeah, it was in Pain and Gain, and it was used very well there. The Mark Wahlberg idiot criminal movie.
That movie is not that recent, is it? That's like from like solidly almost a decade ago.
Oh yeah, it's like from the Obama era, I think. But I feel like I've seen it more. I forget where I heard it in recently, but I did.
I'll take your word for it.
All right. Maxie writes, look at the situation they got me facing. Seriously, this is an impossible choice. Didn't seem impossible for a lot of you, but we'll get to that later. Daniel Schultes writes, I was going to comment about Weird Al, but then I saw that a bunch of people already did. Then I was going to comment about how white the audience is until I saw that a bunch of people already did that too. So now I'm going to leave this pretentious meta comment that adds nothing.
This is sort of Twitter discourse in a nutshell, right? This is the circle of life.
I think we can all agree that it's nice that Coolio and Al were able to squash it.
Yeah.
That seems important.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Christopher Ladd writes, anyone who mentioned Weird Al should have their voting privileges revoked. It's Dre and Snoop, and it shouldn't be remotely close. That's like saying Mozart is better than Bach because of Rock Me Amadeus.
Is there a consensus better between Mozart and Bach? Like, I don't know. Who would win that in a song versus song?
Yeah, there you go. How have we not gotten to that yet?
Yeah,
that's an April Fool's episode in the making.
Ina Kleina Nacht music versus a cantata in, I forget what key it is. All right. Bad Cat Bucky writes, somewhere in Gangsta's Paradise DNA, you could make a good case of it being compared to an ode to Valhalla. Equipped with lyrical descriptions and a background choir welcoming gangsters to the hall, Gangsta's Paradise is as mythical to a modern Valhalla as it gets. That is insightful. I like that comment.
The one major complaint I do have about Gangsta's Paradise is that I don't think the chorus is very good. Like, obviously it sounds great, but the lyrics itself are kind of, one thing, it's mostly just one line over and over again. And I don't think it really tracks for me. They're kind of recreating the Stevie line and just sort of adjusting it to be about Gangsta's Paradise. It doesn't really resonate with me the same way the verses do. But again, it sounds so mighty. And
it's a better line than Pastime Paradise. The fuck is a Pastime Paradise?
Also a fair question.
All right. One last one. Golden E. Pump writes, I mean, G-Thang is a staple of G-Funk, but I met Coolio in Plymouth, UK a few years ago, and he shared respect for Stevie Wonder over a few tokes before disappearing into a big car. So he's got to win, basically.
Seems just like a great guy, Coolio. I mean, obviously, I can't remember if we talked about the fact that he died, I think, was it earlier this year, like a few months ago?
We tried to say at the top, yeah, it was pretty recent.
Very sad. By all accounts, just a good dude and just kind of wanted to make a life for himself and his kids. And ended up with a couple of the biggest songs ever. But
yeah,
he will be missed, even if his legacy is not obviously as wide and overshadowing as Dre's.
Yeah. I don't know why he faded so quickly. It feels like he should have had at least a couple more years, but I don't know. Like he should have thrived in the Puffy era, and he didn't. And I'm not sure why.
He also kind of got stuck doing soundtrack singles after this, and like he had the song from the movie Eddie, "It's All the Way Live Now," which was like a decent hit, but just kind of made him look cheap, I think, after Gangsta's Paradise. And then he was also on the Space Jam soundtrack. He just kind of became like this. He kind of became the soundtrack rapper, and it's tough to come back from that in the same way.
Yeah, I think he was in like Batman and Robin, like God, in the background somewhere.
Very possible.
He was supposed to be in Daredevil, and his plotline got cut. And he lost his hair. I mean, going bald is tragic for everybody, but it's super tragic when you're Coolio.
100%.
So that's what happened there. All right. And at last, the results. Let's get a guess, because, I had no idea which way this was going to go.
I got to leave this to you, Utz, because I apologize, looked.
Well, I unfortunately voted in this poll, which is one of the reasons why I shouted out to Todd that I had some very strong opinions about this matter. So I think we're just gonna have to do the unveiling without any bold predictions.
Yeah.
Here.
For a 543-233 split, that's 70-30. We are now living in a gangster's paradise.
This is the worst result in the history of this show.
This is very tough. So let me ask you real quick, like right off the top here. If the parody that Weird Al does on the Bad Hair Day album is of Nothing But a G Thing, is it like an exact flip of those two numbers, do you think?
Yes.
I don't know, but it truly is a
Nothing But an Amish thing
here.
Yes.
Like, I don't think there's any denying that that's what a weird. Yep, there it is. Literally the same song, but all right.
Yeah, you can kind of fill in the blanks there.
God, I hope that's not the only reason. That makes me so sad. I think
it just ends up even. I think that would even it out. But like I said, Gangsta's Paradise is like so far up there. Everyone fucking loves this song, except two people in this room, I guess.
Well, I do love the song too, but yeah, I mean, usually when I have to try to predict the way y'all's listeners are going to go, I go with whichever one has the more Spotify plays and YouTube views. And in that sense, it's not even a contest. So
I have cultivated an audience of joiners. Yes.
A populist audience, I would say.
Got him.
All right. That was the winner. Thank you all for watching. Thank you so much. And it's Lena's birthday. And if you want to celebrate Lena's birthday, why don't you donate to Lena's,
oh my gosh,
Lena's Patreon?
Yes. And by that, Todd means this Patreon. And also, by the way, we do the Shatner question every episode. If you like the dumb Shatner question, you happen to like Star Trek, as it happens, as we're recording this, a musical based on Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, which I co-conceived 8 years ago, is currently off Broadway at the Players Theater on McDougal right now. It's running for 5 weeks. So if you're in the New York area and you have an interest in something like that, you know what? I was only partially involved, so it's very good. I would recommend checking it out.
All right. And if you can't do that, just donate to our Patreon. Give us $1 and you will get our bonus episodes. For some reason, this month you made us watch a single episode of SpongeBob. I approve because it's much less work.
I hadn't even seen that yet. That's amazing. All right.
And if you can't do that, just give us a nice review and tell all your friends about us. All right. You ready for the next episode?
Always and never.
All right.
What is it?
Well, I was seeing so many pretty pictures of the coronation. So this next one is going to be London Calling by The Clash versus Anarchy in the UK by The Sex Pistols.
All right. Well, that's an easy one for me, but I'm excited.
I honestly don't know which way I'd go on that. I look forward to listening.
Oh, that'll be fun. All right. So long, everybody.
Bye.